Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. We know that a large number of Americans, albeit not the majority, are angry. They feel that the country's leaders have somehow lost touch with them and their needs, and that somehow the system is rigged against them. In fact, unemployment is at a 10-year low. U.S. manufacturing output has doubled in the past 30 years. The stock market continues to make gains, and U.S. economic growth, while anemic, continues to increase. So what's going on? Why the disconnect, and where does all the anger come from? And why the pushback from both the left and the right? And where do we go from here? We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Sarah Jaffe. She's a Nation Institute fellow. Her work has appeared in The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic. She's the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast and a columnist at New Labor Forum. It is my pleasure to welcome Sarah Jaffe to the program to talk about her new book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Sarah Jaffe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As you've looked at this and studied this over the years, to what extent is so much of the anger that we see out there an anger about dislocation, about deconstruction, about the change in institutions and social constructs, and how much is really about the economy?
Well, I mean, you just listed off a whole bunch of economic indicators. And when you think about those indicators, there's growth, there's output, there's those numbers. If you look at a graph, they're going up, they're going into the pockets of a very small group of people. And for real people, the people who are working in those factories, manufacturing things, the people who are serving you breakfast when you go to the local coffee shop, your neighbors, the people who, the 6 million people who lost their homes in the financial crisis, are not feeling that at all. And if you look at a graph of productivity versus, you know, the gains for regular people, the two have diverged. You know, Timothy Noah wrote a book about this calling it the Great Divergence, right? If regular people's income gains had kept up with productivity gains, if the minimum wage had kept up with productivity gains, it would be somewhere around $23 or $24 an hour. And that's certainly not where it's at right now. So the fact that, like, the economy as this thing that we talk about as sort of this, like, I have a Chrome plugin that changes markets to dragons, because this is kind of how we talk about the market and the economy and all of these things, as though they're like a separate thing over here that we have to keep healthy or else it'll eat us. And it's eating people. You know, the gains are not going to regular people. So dislocation and all of those things come from people not being able to maintain the lifestyle that they became accustomed to or that they look around and see other people having.
But there is a broader global framework to all of this. And certainly while there have been gains that have benefited the wealthy, there's no question about that. As we look at it on a global basis, we see, for example, that those living in extreme poverty in the developing world has gone from 42% back in the mid-90s to about 17% or less now. I mean, there have been global gains as a result of all of this.
Right. And when you look at global gains, that's, again, the metrics that we're using here measure very specific things. So yes, like, a poor person in the United States still lives on much more money per day than a poor person in Bangladesh, certainly, right? You cannot possibly compare those. That's why our companies keep shipping jobs to Bangladesh, because you can pay somebody much, much less in Bangladesh because it takes much less to live on. So trying to sort of compare all of these things, and, you know, my book is about the United States. That's what I cover. That's what I, you know, that's what I know. And for people here, it's always it's a question of relative, right? If you grew up feeling like you were, you know, solidly middle class, if your dad worked in a factory in Indiana or Ohio, and then that factory closed down and went to Bangladesh, went to Mexico, went to China, and your dad no longer has that job, and the job that you can get now is a service industry job that doesn't have a union, that doesn't have job protections, that pays somewhere in the neighborhood of $9 or $10 an hour as opposed to $15 to $20. That's a whole different world. And that's a world that more and more people in this country are facing. And when they look around and see politicians in both parties have done basically nothing about it, right? the appeal of Donald Trump, whether we like it or not, was that he told people he was going to make things better. He's, you know, make America great again when you feel like America is not great anymore, is a compelling argument. And he gave people someone to blame. And I happen to think he's blaming the wrong people. But, you know, he gave people somebody to blame for their problems.
I mean, the irony of all this is that, well, we've been talking a little bit about the global aspect of this and the outsourcing aspect, that that's almost a thing of the past already. I mean, we talked briefly, or I mentioned the statistics in terms of manufacturing output. That output has quadrupled with significantly less labor required, obviously, to do that. If you go into an auto plant in America today or anywhere in the world, but even in America, the most modern auto plants are operating with less than a third of the number of people that used to be involved in an auto plant. I mean, automation and artificial intelligence are really displacing even more than outsourcing now.
You know, I have a funny story about automation. I was working on a story a couple years ago in Atlanta, or outside of Atlanta, where Glock handguns are made in a factory there. And I got a tip from a friend who knew somebody who was working nights in this plant. And instead of this being a good full-time union job, again, like we used to expect factory jobs in this country to be, he was a temp. And he was working for a temp agency. And guess what the temp agency was named? Automation. Automation was the name of this company. And I tried and failed to get a comment from this company when I was reporting this story. But, you know, there are many things that are contributing to the decline of good, solid jobs in this country, right? The fact that a lot of politicians in these same, you know, these states that used to be the manufacturing belt in this country have now seen sustained attacks on union rights, right? Indiana is a right to work state. Michigan is now a right to work state. That you've seen the use and more of perma-temps who make much less money, have no benefits, can be hired and fired much more easily than a worker who has a union contract. Jobs are still factories are still closing and they're still going overseas. I mean, Donald Trump is bragging about saving 1,000 jobs at the Carrier plant in Indiana right now, right? Because they were about to close their factory and open one in Mexico. And they're still, by the way, going to close a factory and open one in Mexico. They're just going to keep some jobs in Indiana because they got massive tax breaks to do so, which again doesn't solve the overall problem that the wealth is still being siphoned upward into a smaller and smaller, in the pockets of a smaller and smaller group of people.
I mean, one of the things we're seeing, for example, I mean, one of the largest groups of blue-collar workers still is those that drive trucks. I mean, it's approximately 3 million people, as I understand it. Within 10 years, that number will be reduced by half or less because of autonomous vehicles.
Yep. I mean, here's the thing also. We treat all of these things the same way we sort of talk about the economy and the market as if it's a dragon over here that's just going to do what it wants and we just have to keep it happy. We talk about technological changes if it's inevitable and the results of it are inevitable. And obviously, human beings like to invent new things and we have this constant drive towards innovation, which is, you know, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. If you figure out a way to automate away picking up garbage, right, which is one of the most dangerous jobs in this country. Garbage collectors get killed on the job, I think, more than twice as often as police officers. That's not a fun job. The people who pick up garbage probably don't enjoy the picking up garbage part. But in many places, it's a union job. You have good protections and it's paid well because it's a dirty job. If you could automate that away, okay, fine. But what you then have to do is figure out what you're going to pay. How are the people who were doing that job going to survive? The same with coal mining, which is also a dangerous, really, really unpleasant job to do. But because people fought for years to organize the coal fields and to make those good jobs, now the places where there were coal mining jobs, you know, people miss them because they had a solid, you know, they had a solid wage, they had solid benefits, they had a way to raise a family, and now they don't. And these are questions not of technology or a lack of technology, they're a question of politics and what we decide we're going to do about that. Are we just going to let people starve because we've decided we have better technology now, we don't need as many coal miners, we don't need as many factory workers, we don't need as many truck drivers? What are we going to do about that? And it's related again to the question of who is controlling the power and the money here. And if automating away certain jobs is a way for rich people to just have no labor costs at all, as opposed to, you know, minimal labor costs, which is what they like to have, then we're going to have an even more unequal, even more miserable, and even more angry and unstable society than we already have.
Some of the disruption addresses what consumers want. I mean, that's the other side of this equation. I don't know if you saw the video. It was actually just released yesterday by Amazon about this prototype supermarket. I guess they're doing the prototype in Seattle, and this is ultimately something they want to roll out. Where you go into the store, basically, you swipe your app as you go into the store, and you have your cart. You buy whatever it is that you're going to buy, or you put it in your bag, and you leave the store. There's no line. There's no checkout. It's automatically charged to you. It's like an Uber experience in a grocery store. And as you well know, I mean, the Grocery Clerks Union was at one point one of the stronger unions in the country. This isn't a question of self-serve. This is a question of no-serve. And part of it is, it's what consumers want.
Somebody's still going to have to stock the grocery store. Somebody's still going to have to make sure the products are where they need to go. Somebody's going to have to maintain the technology. Again, it's not a question of just like this is inevitably going to happen. Why is Amazon doing this? Is it what consumers want? I never was given a survey. I don't know if they've done a survey that says what people really want in the grocery store is, you know, to never have to talk to another human. Maybe it is. I mean, you know, I was really pleased when they started having home delivery, takeout, you know, food by app, so I didn't have to call and have a conversation with somebody. Sure, that's fine. But again, the question that we should be asking here is not like, should we preserve what are, you know, a grocery checkout job is not a great job these days. This is not, we're not talking a full-time 40-hour-a-week steady job with benefits and, you know, paid vacation most of the time. The jobs that they're going to automate away are the jobs where the workers have the least power. And they're going to, I mean, again, I just, you know, we talk about these things as if they're just some monster that's going to come down here and happen, and we can't do anything about it because we're just, you know, we're powerless in the face of whatever. No, we're not powerless in the face of anything. That's why people are in the streets. That's why people are going on strike. That's why workers are organizing. That's why their $15 an hour movement is swept across this country, because people realize that the only way to actually carve a good life out of all of this is to shift the balance of power.
I guess the argument is looking at the larger issues. I mean, $15 an hour certainly is an important and a good movement. I don't think that you know, we'd find too many people that we know that disagree with that. But that's really a short-term solution.
I mean, people making a living wage is a pretty long-term solution. It's been a pretty long-term solution in this country so far. You know, it's not a short-term solution. When you say, okay, if you are going to have people who work for you, you have to pay them a significant proportion of what you're making. It's not a short-term solution unless you're arguing that jobs are going away tomorrow. Kind of here for jobs going away tomorrow, but that's a whole other discussion. And, you know, again, I am not a futurist. I'm not going to predict what's going to happen. But what I'm saying is that the course of human development, the course of what the quote-unquote economy looks like, these are things that are decided by people. These are things that are decided in offices. They're decided in Congress. They're decided in state houses and city councils around the country. These are decisions that are made by people for things to go a certain way. And they are decisions that, okay, if we're going to, again, if we have enough technology that we don't need however many million people in America are working age and in good enough health to be working, if that we don't need work full time for all of these people because we have robots to do all of it, okay, then how are we going to solve that? Mm-hmm. And that's a political question that we need to answer. And the thing that people are saying by getting involved in various social movements now is that the way we're doing it now is not working. It's not working for the majority of people. I mean, if it works for Amazon, that's great. But ultimately, what's going to happen if we have a tiny group of people who are very, very rich and a whole bunch of people who don't have jobs is that is a recipe for a deeply unstable country.
some would argue that those are the bigger issues that we need to be addressing within the political framework, and those are the things that are not being discussed at all.
There are people are having these conversations constantly. In fact, I'm kind of tired of having this conversation because I'm constantly being asked, well, you know, if the $15 an hour movement succeeds and they get raises, aren't they just going to automate away those jobs? Yes, well, that's another problem we have to solve. But the problem that we have to solve right now is that people don't have any power. And the way they have power is they get together and they organize. And they make demands. And that's how factory jobs became good jobs in the first place. And so the fact that, okay, $15 an hour movement brings together a whole lot of people who are talking to each other about their working conditions. And those people now are in an organization and they know how to reach each other. And okay, so then you raise the wage to $15 an hour in Seattle, in San Francisco, in New York. And you start losing jobs, or your boss cuts back on your hours, or whatever. Okay, then that's the next problem that you solve. But when you are organized and you're actually working together with other people, then you can actually work on solving those problems. But you can't solve anything if you just kind of sit back and say, well, the guys at Amazon are going to decide what our future is.
To what extent does the political discourse need to be talking about these things, politicians and elected officials?
I mean, again, they are talking about this, right? This election was, you know, premised on one guy telling people that he was going to bring back jobs by kicking out immigrants and building a wall and, you know, overturning trade deals. And, well, you know, what he actually did with the carrier plant was exactly the opposite of what he was promising to do on the campaign trail. But he was saying he's going to bring back jobs. And, you know, again, his actual plan to do that is non-existent. But that was an answer. That was a set of answers to that problem. This was, you know, and Hillary Clinton, I would argue, lost because she didn't make these arguments. And she didn't have a counter argument to this argument that we're, what we have to do to bring back jobs is this, that, and the other thing. And that's part of the problem. But, you know, Bernie Sanders was also making arguments about this and talking about the need to raise wages and talking about the need to think about what we do with our trade policy and how that encourages jobs in different places. That these are questions that are deeply involved in our political discourse. And the answers that we've been getting mostly have been bad ones. You know, the fact that Obama was continuing to push another massive trade deal that would, again, increasingly concentrate power in the hands of a handful of corporate executives during an election season while this was a massively unpopular thing to be pushing really, you know, speaks volumes about what people's solutions to these problems are. But these are conversations that are happening everywhere.
To what extent do they need to happen? Sort of brings it back to something we talked about at the beginning. To what extent do they need to happen with a global perspective, as opposed to just what we're hearing now, this America First perspective?
I mean, you can't separate the world at this point, right? There's no sort of closing down borders and shutting everything down the way. And it's interesting, this is, as you're saying, the Trumpism is not an American-only force, right? The Brexit vote, everybody has compared the Trump election to the Brexit vote in England, but there are right-wing nationalist movements growing all across Europe. The sort of reaction to globalization is now this like doubling down on nativism in a really, you know, frightening and harmful way that's scapegoating immigrants who are mostly the ones who are the most screwed by the global economy, right? When you have people who are migrating in search of work, that's because there is no work where they're coming from. And so we really, I can't stress enough that Donald Trump is blaming the people who are the least responsible for the problem and who are in fact the most victimized by it. And so, yeah, to think about fixing trade deals, part of that is, in fact, you know, it's we're actual workers in this country would actually benefit by better labor standards and regulations in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, in places where where the factories that used to be here are going. Because if those workers are still cheap and exploitable and, you know, working in factories that are falling down and burning down all around them, then, you know, companies have every incentive to go somewhere else. And we all lose. And so, yeah, to challenge the sort of the Trump argument that we can just sort of, you know, put up walls around America and then it will be great again, we do have to think about how we're actually all interconnected, how the phenomena that are hurting people in Ohio are also hurting people in you know, Bangladesh, or hurting people in Mexico, you know, are hurting people in Greece.
And are you seeing that realization among the people that are organizing that you write about, and the people that are beginning to take action, that are trying to take action?
You know, the first person that I talked to at Occupy Wall Street was from Spain. And she had been part of the Indignados movement in Spain after the, you know, the financial crisis over there. And she had come to Occupy Wall Street to help people figure out how to set up their movement here. You know, I was in Ireland this past spring for the election and the anniversary of the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising over there, and talking to you know, people on the Irish left who had just been organizing around water charges that were being imposed for the first time. Water is paid out over there out of general taxation. And they had this colossal movement in resistance to these water charges being imposed because of basically because of the EU imposed austerity after the financial crisis again. And they are working with people in Greece and people in Spain, that there's like the growing sense that, again, that the challenge to these nativist right-wing nationalist movements, you know, in Greece, they literally have a Nazi party that is the third largest party in their parliament, the Golden Dawn, that this is a problem that is only going to be solved by all of us actually talking about it and connecting and thrashing it out together.
Is there some relevance in those organizations, and is there some relevance in those that are trying to organize with respect to how fast events move today? That unlike in the past with traditional organizing, things today are changing and moving so rapidly, it puts an added pressure on the effort to organize.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing also, you know, because of the internet, because of the same factors that allow, you know, Wall Street to make trades at the speed of, you know, a millisecond, you can also organize a protest in, you know, 2 hours. You can put out a tweet and tell people to come somewhere. And you can build these networks in a different way now through technology. And that's also happening in things like labor organizing. Our Walmart, the organization of Walmart workers, just put out an app for organizing. It's basically for Walmart workers to talk to each other about the problems that they're having in the workplace and to be connected to other Walmart workers who are facing the same problems in different stores around the country. And this is their, you know, their attempt again to say, like, there are over a million employees of Walmart in the U.S. And those, you know, those employees would have a tremendous amount of power if they were all organized and connected to each other. But it's impossible to send one organizer, you know, to each Walmart store, or each Walmart, you know, employee. But if you can actually figure out ways to connect them faster and connect them to each other so that they can talk to each other about what they need, that would be really powerful. And also, I should mention that the Walmart workers have done international solidarity with the workers from Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, the factory that collapsed, where goods that are sold in Walmart were being manufactured. And they've worked with immigrant workers in Louisiana, guest workers who were packing seafood that was sold in Walmart. And so you do see this, again, this consciousness, particularly with retail work, because it's, you know, the supply chain for retail is so international that, again, the workers understand that they're all being squeezed by the same company at the top and by the, you know, a family that has more wealth than the bottom 50% of America. And so when you look at it that way, again, like, if capital is international, as global, if, you know, Walmart has its supply chain that spreads around the world, then the only way to actually, you know, have a force that can counter that is to have all of the people who are being squeezed by Walmart work together.
What will represent, in your view and in the view of the workers or the people that you talk to, what will represent critical mass? When will it there be a sense that this is something that is not going to go back in the proverbial bottle?
I mean, it's not going back in the proverbial box, but I don't know what critical mass, you know, what would winning look like? It depends. People have racked up things that are actual victories, right? Cities have voted for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Workers have won things like paid sick days. And a bunch of people just voted for Donald Trump and feel like they won something. There are different metrics of winning here, right? And it's a real question of what that actually is going to look like and how you actually get different movements to connect to each other to understand that their struggles are actually basically all against the same small group of people. And think about what that power looks like. I mean, does it look like a new political party? Does it look like taking over one of the existing ones? What victory would be is, you know, it's all of history is a product of, people's struggle, and it's going to go on. It's not like there's going to be a moment where it stops. If the financial crisis taught us anything, it should have taught us that this idea that there was an end of history after the collapse of the Soviet Union claims were wildly inflated.
Sarah Jaffe, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Sheckman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.